Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.
Opinions expressed on the First Coast Connect Week in Review are those of our panelists and do not reflect the views of WJCT News 89.9.
And good morning. I'm Dan Scanlon, sitting in this week for Ann Schindler, and it is Friday, so that means we've got an interesting show ahead. So among our topics, one downtown development project hits a roadblock, others are going full steam ahead, former Jacksonville cop charged with child sex crimes, and we learn what will replace Sun Ray Cinemas. Again, it's the roundtable, and to talk about that and more, I'm joined by Nikesha Williams, contributor for Jacksonville Today.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. David Barline is on line with us, Metro reporter for the Florida Times Union. Good morning, David.
Good morning, everybody.
We got Jack Webb, attorney and former city council president in Jacksonville.
Thanks for having me back, Dan. Good morning.
Yeah, and good morning. And Renata DiGregoria, reporter for the First Coast News team and having a lot of fun, even some Sunray experience this week. So
so much fun.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for everybody being here. Now, I'm going to open this up wide. I'm sure we all were watching TV at 6:30 and then finally at 7:10, the president hits the microphones and we all, I'm sure, watched or have heard about his first unscripted news conference since the issues arose of how well he did or didn't do during the debate. So let's just open it up. Any thoughts about how President Biden did yesterday with 11 news media?
Everyone looks to me. Okay, sure.
I wasn't looking.
He's an 81-year-old man who was running for president. Does he have wisdom and experience? Yes. Is he still 81? Yes. Did it show that he's 81? Yes. Did it show that he's the Biden of 2020? No. Is he the Biden of 2016? No. Is he still the best chance for American democracy, in my opinion? Yes. I've had this conversation a lot recently with people about what are we going to do? What are the Democrats going to do? And the reality of the situation is the opponent, whoever the Democratic nominee is, and it's presumptive that it is still going to be President Biden at this time, the opponent is someone who is charged with 91 federal counts, has been convicted of some of those, and whose tactics of delay and deny and obfuscate have allowed them to continue to ascend among the Republican Party, but then also to have a grip and a chokehold on that side of the aisle that is so strong that Washington itself is dysfunctional and that we are no longer debating the best for the country. We are talking about what keeps people in power and basically stripping back all of the rights and the freedoms that are guaranteed in the Constitution, as well as all of the protections that are guaranteed to the people. And you see that across the government, not just in the executive branch, but also in the House of Congress and also in the judicial branch at the Supreme Court. And so it cannot be understated that neither of these candidates are the best, right? But one is absolutely, in my opinion, worse than the other. And then what becomes at stake if we continue to do this Democratic, liberal, progressive infighting is that you're no longer focused on your opponent, and you're no longer focused on the issue of creating a more perfect union for the American people. You are focused on maintaining your political power and doing that by running who you think might be the best candidate or who you think might could win, but then you're gambling with everyone's future, and that should not be understated. So, like, at this point, I'm not watching a bunch of news conferences or debates. I'm going to ride till the wheels fall off for the side. That's going to mean that I can live my life relatively normally and not have to fear what the United States might look like under a second Trump presidency, because that does actually scare me.
You know, Dan, let me, where do you start with this story? I mean, you make a great point. He's not the same Joe Biden of 2020. That begs the question, what's he going to look like in 2025? Okay, don't know. But that said, begs the question, how did we get here? Okay, I mean, the political, it's assumed Joe's taking the position, President Biden's taking the position, he is the best person possible to defeat Donald Trump in November. Okay, that's all well and good, but we really don't know that, do we? Because, again, the political process, that the primary system was not robust, I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of other candidates. And the Biden administration, the Biden camp, went out of its way to make certain that there wasn't a whole lot of opposition. Okay? So he is, we are where we are. I think that what's shocking to me is the release of frustration and negative energy by the media and the Democratic rank and file down the, you know, down ballot that we're seeing now. And what's lost in all of this, it's now become Joe Biden as the focus. And okay, is he going to be replaced or not? No one ever talked about what Donald Trump did at the debate, right? I mean, the Atlantic Constitution, whatever, the New York Times, they all called for him to step down. The only editorial group out there in the country was the Philadelphia Inquirer that looked into it and said, how come we're not talking about Donald Trump? You know, what about the gibberish? I mean, the guy
who does not understand the issues to even comment on them. And that goes back to what you just said about, you know, Joe Biden being the best candidate to Donald Trump. To beat Donald Trump, maybe that was true in 2020, but let's think about how we got here. Neither side of the aisle, the Republicans or the Democrats, have done the work to groom political leadership to actually run this country. We have had dynasties in the Clintons and in the Bushes, and then we had the ascendant president of Obama, and the Democrats seem to think that Hillary Clinton, it was her turn. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't see any pushback or any real primary process between her in 2016 other than between her and Bernie. And that just seemed to be like infighting, that he was just going to keep going. So we keep getting to this position where there is no one in the line and there's no one trained and there's no one ready to step into the role of leadership to actually run this country. This is the hardest job in the world. And it shows in what? Joe Biden. He was 77, 76 when he ran. In 2020, he's now 81, and we all know that this job ages you. Mm-hmm. So if he was if he's 81 in age, he might be 88 on the inside because of what he's dealing with. And that's not to detract from what he can bring to the table or that he can even do it. It's just to say that he's an older and elderly man, and there's no one that is available to replace him. And the people that they think are available to replace him, namely Vice President Kamala Harris, is going to face the onslaught of misogynoir, which is sexism and racism, and the fact that she is untested. So why are we talking about who can run the country when at this point we are 3-4 months out from the election? There are no other choices.
Okay, now, those who haven't spoken are journalists who cover news conferences with candidates. So I wanted to get Renata and David's thoughts on, as a journalist, if you'd been sitting in that room, your thoughts, if you'd had the chance to pose a question. And here are the questions. Renata first.
Well, the thing that I always pay attention to in these press conferences is what the reporters are asking, how they're asking it, who's doing the questioning. And of course, the first questions that we all mostly saw were really drilling Biden on, are you sure you're capable of still doing this job? And I think one of the biggest takeaways from the press conference last night is that it is still going to be Biden versus Trump. And we could have seen maybe Biden was going to say something else last night that would have kind of changed that. But really nothing changed since then, when really all the eyes were on this press conference anyways. And then I saw NBC was reporting last night too, at least 3 more House Democrats are calling for him to withdraw after last night. But he's saying, or Biden is saying, that the summit went well. But then, of course, America's waking up this morning to see all those clips online of him mistakenly saying President Putin instead of President Zelensky, and then calling Kamala Harris Vice President Trump. And so the public's kind of waking up to see all of this. But as far as anything changes, we're still in the same place that we were yesterday.
And David, your thoughts again as a reporter who's covered many news conferences with many candidates.
Yeah, I winced a little bit when he mistakenly called his vice president Donald Trump. That was the kind of thing that you were worried from the standpoint of that kind of mistake happening. I thought he did well in terms of the substance. He really knows that field very well. You know, a lot of running for president, though, is the future, looking towards the future. He still comes across as a 81-year-old man, somebody who is doesn't have come across with a lot of vigor, a lot of natural enthusiasm. He's pretty monotone in terms of his presentation. So it was basically what you would expect a news conference about NATO to be about. and but it didn't really come across as somebody who had a great deal of enthusiasm, a feeling of uplift when you listen to him answer the questions about being somebody who was looking forward to leading the country for another 4 years. I know he said he was. I'm just talking about the optics of it and his presentation.
You know, someone in the room that I was watching it with said he needed some water. He was constantly coughing, and that was the physical thing I noticed. He seemed sharper. I'd love to know what the comment was from the journalist. Somebody said something because he stopped and said, "What?" or "Excuse me?" Like he didn't like what he heard. I wish someone had heard that and passed that on. We've got Javon in Billings, Montana. Javon, you're on the air with a comment.
Billings.
Good morning. And I am a registered voter in registered voter in Florida, still deeply concerned about what's happening. But whether it's about the candidates or Project 2025, the most important thing that people can do right now is get involved. Politics is a contact sport. If all you're doing is waiting for election day and talking on Facebook or social media, or that's not doing enough, especially at this time. There are grassroots organizations in every community. There are people organizing because that's what it is going to take to actually change the dynamics of what's happening. We need to have a more robust conversation about who does have an opportunity to serve in our as elected officials, but the legal and community ramifications for what's happening are immense, and now is the time for people to find the organizations that are doing the work they care about and to help other people get out and vote, and then to be a help force accountability after election day. So just get involved is the number one thing.
All right. Thank you very much. I'd like to move on, but it looks like we're generating some phone calls. And again, if you want to put your 2 cents in, give us a yell at 904-549-2937. But I say we should go as soon as this clears. We've got Joe from Fleming Island, who also has some comments, but I'm waiting for the button to clear. Joe, you're on the air. Are you there, Joe? Okay. Let us move on then to local news, and there has been no dearth of local news. Josue Garriga, former Jacksonville police officer, now standing trial in federal court, or soon to, because of sex crimes with a minor after it was done locally. And now the newest thing that comes up is while apparently he had an app that would erase certain things off of his phone, there's other evidence that the prosecutors wanted. So let us talk about yet another Jacksonville cop. This is the second in 2 years involved with a minor and things. And I guess my only comment would be, you're trained in law enforcement. What makes you think that certain things can be done that won't be seen? So let's open up the situation with Garriga. A federal judge rules this week that images from his work phone can be used in trial to argue that he had, quote, sexual interest in children.
As a lawyer in the room, let me run with this one, if that's okay. It was interesting. I went back and I pulled, I was reading the articles that that were reported on this case and regarding Judge Howard's ruling. And it was interesting, as you say, Dan, basically because WhatsApp, whatever the app, destroyed the image or destroyed the messages within 24 hours from the young woman. You know, that reflect or that from him to the young woman that reflected his outreach to her that, OK, so you don't have that. You can't get that evidence. So the prosecution sought to introduce the evidence that you described, other images of young women, not necessarily pornographic or in violation of the law, as the judge pointed out, to show a propensity, an interest in bad stuff. OK, judge ruled she relied upon an 11th Circuit unpublished case, but. And I read that case last night, and really disturbing, but it's pretty clear cut. The judge pretty much, she got it right. I mean, obviously, the defense most likely procedurally filed a motion to exclude the evidence under Rule 403, the Federal Rules of Evidence, and the court said, listen, you know, I'm going to balance it out here. That is, the risk of unfair prejudice to the defendant is outweighed by the probative value of the evidence. And I think in this factual circumstance, given the fact that the other evidence that would assist the prosecution in proving the case was not available to it, she let it in. Now, is it a good ruling? Yeah, it is. And it's going to withstand scrutiny at the 11th Circuit as well.
So perchance someone is looking for a trend or an interest, not per se anything with nudity or pornography, but an interest that may be shown by a subject of this case.
That's correct. And what she did was, you know, she gave a limiting instruction. That is, you know, when it's given to the jury, there's nothing illegal about this stuff. So it's offered for this purpose only, not to establish that he engaged in the behavior he's accused of charged with here, but to show his propensity.
Nikesha?
Yes. First, I want to say it wasn't young women that there were pictures of. There were young girls. And mm-hmm. I think that's a very different classification to make, because the crime for which he charges for pressuring a 17-year-old girl to have sex with him, and then the pictures found on his phone that they are able to use and to submit to the jury are of 10 and 12-year-old girls. Mm-hmm. As a grown man, why do you have pictures of girls, young girls, prepubescent girls on your phone? I don't care if they're fully clothed. As an officer of the law, someone who was supposed to be held to this level of integrity and moral ethics, there should not be pictures of young girls on your phone unless it's your daughter, period. And so the propensity that we're trying to show that he has an interest, whatever interest it is, be it a purient interest, a sexual interest, or he just likes looking at little girls, whatever it is, it's operating in a gray area where there should not be one. Young girls are already overly sexualized at a young age, and they face that over-sexualization and then the catcalls and everything that comes with it as they grow up into young women and even adults. So someone who is a police officer having these images is dead wrong. Someone who was a police officer charged as someone who was trying to pressure a 17-year-old girl to have sex with him and now is facing trial for that and has these other images on his phone, they needed to go through. The jury needs to see them, and they're going to establish a record of where his mind might be. And I don't think there was anything wrong about allowing them in.
And Renata, have you covered any of the Garriga case?
I have, right in the beginning of it all. And mm-hmm. something I thought was interesting, too, with the defense's argument, I don't know, maybe you guys can weigh in about this, too, is with one of the defense attorneys arguing that it could have been used for police work. I feel like without knowing what the pictures are and, like, seeing that all in trial, and I know another person in the courtroom said, like, hey, that's not going to hold up in court. So I guess we'll just kind of see what happens from there with as far as that part of it goes.
And I guess it will depend on how defense responds to initially showing this. Once they're shown to the jury, what do they come back with and come up with something that could be legitimate as to a reason why? Even have someone who can say, yes, that is because of a case that he was covering. And again, that balances. I've had the honor of being on a civil trial jury, so I've actually gotten to sit in the box and watch a 4-day trial happening with a very well-known local attorney right in front of me who I couldn't talk to, who I knew very well. It's an intriguing thing. I would recommend any journalist who can get on a jury trial. Be fair, open-minded, but you will learn so much about the process. The judge was a blast. The judge was treating some of the attorneys like, I'm sure, her children. And basically, and they was close to contempt of court, I'm sure, Jack. But again, this is the second police officer, Clay County, doing the investigation, Jacksonville police officer, who got into trouble. I'm trying to remember who it was. I've got it in my notes. This was Alejandro Carmona Fonseca, who was chatting up young men in a Clay County gym and sending and corresponding with nude photos. And he's in prison now. So what does this say? Does this say anything about police officers in general, or am I really overreaching here?
I think that, I hate to say it, but the fact that and David's here, so I'm sure he wants to jump in as well, but the fact that, I don't know, it's a hard job, I guess. It doesn't excuse anything, but, I mean, I guess you're surrounded by that kind of foulness every day. I mean, I don't know. I don't know. I don't think it's attributable to 99.9% of the police officers out there, but at the same time, when there's It's implicit. It's incumbent upon the constitutional officer, that is the sheriff, to make certain that you're weeding these people out in the psychological evaluations. And if you do have people, officers, who are involved in these types of investigations, that you're doing regular psychological evaluation of them to see if they've just kind of, if they're right for the job.
And David Barlon, you and I both shared the Times Union newsroom back in the day, and I'm sure we've had conversations about these. What are your thoughts about this case and the fact that it is, again, the second Jacksonville police officer involved in some kind of younger sexual case?
Yeah, one thing about the case that I was surprised by is that the prosecution was not able to get the messages that were deleted by the WhatsApp messaging system. I always thought that, you know, there was a footprint there and that people might think they're deleting it, but if you had a prosecution, they could find that stuff. So that was a little bit of a surprise to me that this is an issue in terms of doing the prosecution. And then beyond that, obviously, he's presumed innocent until there's a chance to have the jury render a verdict. But, you know, the law of averages is that you have a large police force. There's going to be people on that police force who commit crimes. And I think, Dan, you made the point that it's almost more surprising that a police officer would do it, given that surely police officers understand the law, how it applies, and should have really an understanding of it from that side of the equation. But we'll see what the jury does in this case. It looks like it's going to rest a lot on the credibility and testimony of the 17-year-old.
And don't forget, there is a state-level felony case in Clay County pending on him. We've got a call from Charles on the west side about the trial. So, Charles, you're on the air.
Hey, yeah, hi, good morning, All-Stars. my question is, in an evidentiary manner, in Harvey Weinstein's case, they had all the other victims, and then the judge ruled that because they weren't directly related to the woman who was assaulted, they had to throw all that out. So I'm wondering if this could have any bearing on the evidence of in his case, in the cop's case.
Jack, you got any comment on that as the resident attorney?
Yeah, I do, actually. First of all, this is a federal trial. It's not a state trial. Okay, Harvey Weinstein, I believe, was New York. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. So whatever, the law, the analysis is the same. The caller makes a really good question. That said, as I said before, the trial court judge has discretion to make these calls. Okay, and she made the call, and she said based on the rule. This is what the rule says. I'm going to allow it. In fact, the rule says a court may exclude relevant evidence if its probative value is substantially outweighed by danger of unfair prejudice. And that said, the case law is very clear that you should interpret that rule in a very broad manner so as to allow admissibility. So again, it's not going to be thrown out like the Harvey Weinstein stuff was. I'm not real familiar with all of that, just conceptually, but I think she's on firm legal ground on this one.
Okay, well, don't forget, too, that Officer Garriga did have another controversy in his past, and that with 22-year-old Jamie Johnson and a stop of a car that ended up in a police-involved shooting that killed Mr. Johnson. And unfortunately, I think Garriga's body cam did not function, but that video is tough to watch. And while the family settled a lawsuit they filed against the sheriff's office, and JSO, state attorney, ruled the shooting justifiable. That may or may not have any bearing at all on this case, but it is just one more thing to remember about this police officer.
Well, it's a good point. Well, there's been no move to introduce, the evidence of a pretextual traffic stop that resulted in the shooting. So now if that was admitted, that would clearly probably not be probative. So that's why the defense or the prosecution is not attempting to introduce that type of evidence. So.
Okay. Any other thoughts before we move on to the next bombshell? I had Mayor Deegan sitting right here, and we were talking about the Laura Street Trio this week, and that has become a bit of an issue. Development, yes. Development, no. I actually am old enough to have gone into that bank building and actually cashed a check with someone. And it was a stunning, stunning interior, marble columns and everything. And we had such high hopes for that. And now, once again, the Laura Street Trio, the bank building, the two towers next to it, is on hold. And on June 28th, the board, Downtown Investment Authority, voted unanimously to end negotiations with the Southeast Development Group. The DIA had offered $87 million in city incentives, $8.3 million of that before construction begins. But there were some issues there. And the mayor herself told me, she says, that has to get done. It will get done, some development. And my comment was, that's very much a part of downtown that needs that boost. So the thoughts about where the Laura Street Trio sits and maybe where the state of that part of downtown redevelopment sits. Well, we have a lot of stuff here on the river that's happening.
Well, Dan, I would say that it's really slipping away in terms of being able to do anything in the immediate future on Laura Street Trio. There's still an outside chance that city council could decide there's a path forward, but that would be unlikely that council on its own could come up with a deal to do it. And the real issue is it's just there is a limit to how much the city is willing to spend and invest in the Laura Street Trio. And so as long as that's the case, that the developer is seeking more money than the city is willing to spend, it's not going to happen.
You know, I keep on talking about Mayor Deegan. We actually have her commenting this week to me about the desire to keep those buildings alive.
I continue to believe that it's a very, very important thing for us to eventually get done. We are absolutely committed to making sure that the trio is preserved. Right now, we are not in a very positive place as far as those talks are concerned, but I have every faith that we will move forward in some way or another to make sure we preserve those buildings.
The question is, later in the week, we heard some media reports that DIA was griping that the city council has been an impediment to developing that. So thoughts there?
Well, that's an interesting point, Dan, because that's where I was going with this whole story. The DIA was created at the behest of developers years back to depoliticize the process and get the politics out of it. And so you got this independent authority, independent agency that is charged with negotiating these deals. They have the subject matter, the expertise to do these things. And so what's going on? All right. Lori Boyer is a very smart lady. And the board unanimously voted to stop the negotiations with the developer. Okay. And it's going back to the council? All right. Okay. Well, that gives me pause for concern, because, you know, that's when you get 19 votes in the council and you got to start doing the money trail, right? Do the money search, right? You know, who's contributing to whom or whatever. My suggestion to the council president would be, give the last proposal to the council auditor. And because the council auditor is neutral, is objective, and work with the administration on this, give me an analysis of the last proposal, and let's, to the extent that we possibly can, get the politics out of it, and then work in concert with the administration to do what we got to do to get this thing done.
But what needs to be done?
It's the same thing that's always needed to be done downtown, and that is to make downtown a destination that people want to go to. Like, people have been talking about redeveloping the Laura Street Trio as long as I've been in Jacksonville, which is since 2011, and maybe even longer than that. I didn't like the suggestion in the TU earlier this week where they said, you know, one avenue to get the deal done could be the city going through a foreclosure lawsuit process like they did with the Bostic building that then became Calfer Chop House. But, you know, we have development everywhere. We're going to have development down by the stadium. We're going to have development where the former landing used to be. La Villa is coming back in different ways. I'm praying the council is going to do the right thing for Out East, even though they took that out of the stadium deal. Mayor Deegan's working on something for Myrtle Street. We have the Emerald Trail. So there's a lot of development happening in the city, in the urban core, in neighborhoods that have been long neglected and that have deserved to have the attention and the prestige as other areas of the city, namely the Southside Town Center specifically. And so at this point, and isn't the council, don't they have a special committee that's now investigating DIA? So at this point, you say that DIA is an independent authority. It's made up of a lot of former council members and political insiders in the city. So it's independent, but it still has that politicization to it. And at this point, it seems more like a pissing match, hope I can say that on air, between the two entities than it does one that is really looking for the best interests of the downtown area to to become one where people not only want to live, but also to work and to play.
We've got a call from Ann on the South Side regarding this. Ann, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning. I want to make a comment about the downtown area. I was born and raised here. I'm of a senior age now, and we are missing the boat because we are not drawing people into the quote-unquote town center, which is exactly what downtown is. We need to treat it the same way the developers have treated other areas and build it up block by block. My thought is to encourage large businesses, big box or whatever they happen to be, encourage them through whatever tax situations people dream up to bring in mass. So let's just say you take a block at a time or a square block at a time, and you bring in four different or six different entities that people want to come to, just like the town center, because it's no different than the town center. It's just vacant. Let's just put it that way.
Okay. Thank you very much. You know, Jack, one quickie wrap up on that?
Real quick, with all due respect, I don't think that the DIA is politicized, to be honest with you. You're going to have politics, but I think, you know, if there's anybody in this city who is going to get in the weeds on any deal and make sure it's right for the city, it's Lori Boyer. And to the extent that she's probably saying, wait a minute, this is not good for the city, there's probably a lot of pressure on politically around town to get it away from the DIA to give it back to the council.
You know, we've been talking about quality of life and Stanley on the north side. Stanley, you're on the air. You have a comment about quality of life, don't you?
Absolutely. Good morning to everybody. I definitely have a quality of life. My main concern has come from the African-American community. When it comes to redistricting, when it comes to the stadium agreement, when it comes to the mall, I'm getting to see from our research, our Imperial research show that racism is increasing, especially with city council. Why had the city council continue to make those bad deals, especially when it comes to the African-American community? Thank you.
Thank you. Well, let's move on to more redevelopment, and that, of course, is the Sunray Theater. Despite a lot of public support to keep that rather fun place alive, with the building's purchase, we now have a very succinct news release this week that says A Place Called Five, a live music venue, is coming in. And that's it. We asked for more. I asked for more information. I know, Renata, you did, and we got the same answer. More coming. To me, if you're going to have this thing open by January, you already have two theaters in there. Put a stage, fresh coat of paint, amp up the sound system, clean up the parking issue, maybe use that parking lot at the end of Park Street, and suddenly you have a live music venue for not that much capital improvement. But Renata, I knew you were out there, so you go, and then we'll go with the rest of the gang.
I did get a tiny bit more information. I don't know how exciting this will be, but I did hear from Marathon Live, which they'll be the people that will be running Five out of the Old Sunray site, that they're expected to be releasing a lineup soon for their first shows. Because that was one of the questions that people had. I had that question, like, hey, what kind of things are you going to have? Is it going to be live music that's local? Are we going to be bringing in a big act comedy people into Little Five Points? But right now, that was kind of like, stay tuned was the answer, basically.
You know, it's interesting, for those of you who've been around long enough, that was once called Club Five. So the name is not that inventive, but obviously Five Points. Some have already commented here in-house that that community is undergoing a bit of a transition again. There's some empty holes. There's some new restaurants coming in, but so let's open up. What does Five Points need?
I feel like it's always been a vibrant community as long as I've been here. And again, that only goes back to 2011, so my knowledge is not that deep or institutional. But I think it's something that we see in all cities, that there is a wave of restaurants and entertainment and venues. And then for whatever reason, things close or change, and then the new wave has to take place. So I feel like this new live music venue is going to be part of that new wave that is going to take place. And as more restaurants come in, others go out, and people really decide what that area is going to look like for the next 5 to 10 years, then I think it'll be back to where it is. But I mean, Five Points is not like dead. It's still bustling. It's just changing.
and changing. But there's a hole or two there, unfortunately. And in fact, that four-story building, there's some good tenants in there. There's a great coffee shop. But there's other holes, including the theater had a pizza place. So there is prime opportunity there.
Something I hadn't noticed before when I was over reporting on this week is you walk by next to Brew, the coffee shop you're talking about. There is Motion Suites, and then there was the shoe place, and they're all empty now. Which
yeah,
I actually,
shoes closed.
Yeah, I don't know why I didn't notice that before, but I mean, there is room for more things. And whenever I've been talking with people about like, hey, you know, we're so sad that Sunray's closing, but people do feel like, at least that I've talked to, that a live music venue fits the vibe, because that was something that was very like, what will fit here and make sense for this particular neighborhood?
You know, Dan, you make a good point. It is it's a community or an area in a state of transition, and it'll find a new equilibrium. I mean, again, the rising property values are the result of a lot of this, right? Again, you know, the bookstore, the coffee shop, whatever, they've been there for a long time. The pizza shop, they can't afford the rents, right? So they're going to move on. So that said, you know, the use of the Sunray building for a music venue, all right, well, that's better than a lot of people would have expected, right? They're not trying to tear the building down and put up a parking garage, okay?
That was one of the rumors.
I know that was. I know that. What's that song?
Joni Mitchell.
Paradise.
Parking lot. Yes.
Yeah. Got it. At least we're not putting up a parking garage.
The question is, parking is an issue there. There are many of my favorite restaurants across the street, and it's sheer luck if I can find a spot. And normally I'm eating dinner at 5 p.m. on a Friday because that's when I can at least get a spot. Let's move on to our next thing. Don't forget, we're talking about the top stories of the week with our panel of journalists. And one of the bigger ones that has come statewide is the change of the signs at the Florida-Georgia borders that now say Free State of Florida. And that has come out with an edict from the governor. And instead of hurry back, instead of drive safe, drive alive, stay alive. So thoughts about the Free State of Florida being the first thing that a tourist, a trucker, a business person, or a resident sees when they come across the state line?
I hate to say this, but really, like I said before, Dan, before we went on the air, whatever happened to arrive alive? I mean, come on, guys. You know, I guess this Free State of Florida refers back to the fact that the state stayed open compared to New York and other northeastern states during the pandemic. Okay, I think that's what this is all about, right? It's just a continuation of that one-hit wonder on the governor's resume that didn't resonate so well as he tried to go national. But it just seems, I don't know, it just seems to me just to be petty.
I mean, arrive
at
alive.
At a waste of taxpayer dollars.
Arrive alive with an FHP trooper waiting for you obviously sent a good message.
Anybody who says that the state of Florida is free has not seen their homeowner's insurance bill recently. I'll just leave it at that.
And you talked about 5 points. We had stories in the past year of the rent going up there and in other parts of vibrant neighborhoods and people having to leave. So, Nakisha, Renata, David, any other thoughts here?
Just because you say something doesn't mean it's true. I'm sure it goes back to 2020 when Florida opened in May and stayed open well thereafter in the recovery that DeSantis credits to himself alone. I also think that it refers to some of his policies, namely his campaign against anything that he deems to be woke and saying that, you know, we're teaching, we're not indoctrinating in Florida. And so that's what he deems freedom. And I'm going to say it again, just because you say something doesn't mean it's true, because Florida, while it might be free for some, it is not free for all, namely minorities, namely the LGBTQ plus communities, namely migrants and their families. So you can say whatever you want to say at the border, but the people who live here know the truth.
David Barline, Times Union, thoughts on the new signs?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's a political slogan. Obviously, they came out of Governor DeSantis and his sort of theme of Florida during the COVID-19 pandemic. I personally prefer Sunshine State. I know that's still on the signs, but if you ask people, the idea of taking a political slogan theme and putting it on your Welcome to Florida signs that people are seeing when they're coming into the state feels a little bit off to me. And I'd like the idea of it just saying, Welcome to the Sunshine State. I don't know if the if, you know, Governor DeSantis will be term limited, can't run again. Does this 20 years from now, are those signs still going to be up, or are we going to be back to saying welcome to the Sunshine State?
And Renata, I don't know how long you've been in Florida, but thoughts?
My first thought when I saw the signs was, well, the old signs, I thought looked fine. How much should we pay for this?
And they just redid the signs at 95 at the Florida-Georgia border. In fact,
see?
They just redid.
They were nice and shiny. Yeah. I don't know. I wasn't the one that ended up reporting on this week, but that was one of the questions I had. It was like, how much should we pay? And then I also looked at it and was like, oh, that's a Governor DeSantis quote. So it's just interesting to me, how do other states also have this going on where it's kind of, like David said, basically a campaign slogan?
Well, it's time to wrap this up with something that we love to do, and we call it the lightning round. David and I have one thing in common, along with the Times Union, is we both used to work, and he still works, at the Wells Fargo building downtown. But if you're interested in something fun and cheap, from 7 to 11 o'clock on Sunday morning, a helicopter is going to take the Wells Fargo letters off the building. Apparently, Wells Fargo wishing to reduce its downtown imprint. So that's my lightning round. What about anybody else?
Sure. I'm going to steal one of you guys because I didn't really have one, and the one that I thought I had is not till next week. So Summer at the Comer is coming back, and I'm going to pass it on.
I also kind of forgot about the lightning round, but I wanted to say I've been going to a RAM Riverside Arts Market, and I got this crazy pickle brine that is it's like dragon fruit flavored. Anyways, it was really weird. Everybody should go check it out.
And Jack?
Be an advertisement.
I want to offer an alternative to Free State of Florida. I want to say, welcome to Florida. Get some sand between your toes.
I like that.
You like that?
Yeah.
All right. You heard it here first.
All right. All right. Better than sand in your shorts, I guess.
I was going to go there.
You're doing something to me there, Jack. I'm sorry. All right. I thank you very much. This has been a fantastic and informative media roundtable here. Oh, David, I'm sorry. He's on the screen today. David, lightning round.
Hey, Tuesday, the mayor presents her 24-25 budget. So it'll be interesting to see her vision for what she wants to get done in the next 3 years.
Yeah, and she was talking about that. I believe that's a Monday announcement, but she wouldn't release anything when we had her here in the studio. So that, in fact, is the hard news lightning round. So I want to thank Nikisha Williams, David Barline, Jack Webb, and Renata DiGregorio for being on a unique roundtable. And next, we'll hear more about the new Bold production opening tonight at the Lumen Repertory Theater. All around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk harder than a match, yeah. Tonight it's a different world. Go out and find a girl. Come on and dance all night. Despite the heat, it'll be alright. And babe, don't you know it's a pity the days can't be like the nights in the summer, in the city, in the summer, in the city. Cool town meeting in the city, dressed so fine and looking so pretty. Cool cat looking for a kitty, gonna look in every corner of the city. Till I'm wheezing like a bus stop, running up the stairs, gonna meet you on the rooftop. But at night it's a different world. Go out and find a girl. Come on and dance all night. Just like the heat, it'll be alright. And babe, don't you know it's a pity the days can't be like the nights in the summer, in the city, in the summer, in the city.
Congarean Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpen.com.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. Serious injury cases are complex, and civil trial attorneys present the evidence juries need to see and hear. More at waynehogan.law.
This week on Science Friday, there are more than 300 drugs in shortage in the U.S., from basic antibiotics to life-saving cancer treatments.
Shortages, they are omnipresent. They smolder along. Now, like we've had other times, it's a five-alarm fire. They never go away.
We'll take a look into what's behind this massive shortage. That's coming up on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 here on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Florida Roundup, short-term rentals. The governor vetoed a bill that would have created state rules for vacation rentals like Airbnbs and VRBOs. How are these short-term rentals impacting your neighborhood? Do you own a property that you rent out to vacationers for a few days at a time? Share your story. Email us radio@thefloridaroundup.org. This is Tom Hudson. Be sure to join us Friday, noon until 1.
World leaders have gathered in the nation's capital this week to mark NATO's 75th anniversary. President Biden says the alliance is the strongest it's been in decades, but his future hangs in the balance with an upcoming news conference that could determine his political fate. How might he and NATO navigate the challenges ahead? That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And welcome back. Well, the Lumen Repertory Theater performing Slow Burn, Edward Albee's one-act plays, starting tonight. A double billing, two Albee one-act plays, Hitting the Stage, American Dream, and The Zoo Story. Here to tell us about the shows is Brian Neese, Artistic Director of the Lumen Repertory Theater, and visiting guest artist David Alford. Welcome, guys.
Good to be here.
Good to be here.
You know, live theater is something that I, as a New York City kid, loved, because I did get to go to Broadway. And then living in San Marco with the oldest community theater in the country in San Marco Square that I could walk to was wonderful. And even the Alhambra, you know, is a great place to go. But we have so many gems from Amelia to Jacksonville to elsewhere. So Slow Burn is part of Lumen Theater's Bold 2024 season. Why is Bold the theme? And how do these two Edward Albee plays come in? You said off air, Albee is something I read as mandatory reading in school, and maybe you said it should be done and seen again.
Yeah. Well, Edward Albee, who is an icon of an American playwright, passed away about 8 years ago or so. And his work, even from the 50s and 60s, his early work, and these two one acts are two of his earliest pieces before he was writing full-length plays, have a lot to say about our world today. A comment on sort of the social mores and expectations and acceptances of what is and is what not, what is inside and what is outside. And they're brutal and hilarious and tender and absurd and a little bit real too at the same time.
I think so. And I also think what's really sort of a kind of eye-opening and a little mind-blowing about both of these plays is they were written around 1960. So he was way ahead of his time. In fact, some of the social commentary he was working on in The American Dream, it so offended so many of the critics in New York that they refused to review the play. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So obviously times have changed.
That means it must be good.
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty eye-opening, and it's pretty sharp and acerbic, and it comes from a very personal place from Albee. And it's I had never read that one act when Brian asked me to come down and work on the piece. And so when I read it, I was kind of like, this is fascinating. I have no idea what I'm going to do with it. But I had to live with it for a while and figure out exactly, I knew what he was talking about, but figuring out a way to deliver that to an audience, a modern audience, was kind of a challenge. And I think the actors have really embraced it.
Well, you are the actor. I have occasionally acted in some independent films, if you want to call it that. But you obviously, from the minute you open your mouth, I'm going, he's the actor. Mm. Well, how do you prepare? And how do you put yourself in the mind of a 1960s play that was maybe a little prophetic?
Yeah. Well, I'm also lucky in that I'm acting in the second piece, directing the first piece, American Dream, and I'm acting in the second one with Brian. I've known Brian for many years, so there's a trust level there that we have, we've worked together before. We also have a sort of a similar aesthetic. And for me, getting into the space is obviously, I don't like to do any role until I've read the play numerous times and figure out what my attack on the character is, but also read some other plays by the writer to figure out exactly, what the oeuvre is, for lack of a better term. And then, of course, you start to make choices for your particular character. And sometimes for me, it's just reading the lines out loud over and over to myself until it sort of falls into a place that makes sense. And that's how I had to approach Peter, who is a, you know, sort of an established businessman in the, in, you know, early 1960s New York. And there's a different vocal pattern, something that I was
lucky. Some of that sneaking in just there?
Well, a little bit, maybe. So so I went to school in New York and studied, and actually my vocal pattern for Peter is sort of patterned after my voice teacher, one of my voice teachers, who was sort of had a very, very East Coast sort of way of speaking, and it was very sort of proper. Mm. And it wasn't English exactly, but, you know, he sort of spoke in a very well-articulated manner. Yeah. And so that's somewhat Peter, a little bit.
Well, let me get the important info out here, because we are running out of time. Yep. Historic San Marco Church, 1620 Naldo Avenue. Mm-hmm. It's Friday, July 12th, 8 o'clock, opening night. Saturday, 8 p.m. Thursday, July 18th, 8 o'clock on Friday, July 19th. Saturday, July 20th at 8. Thursday, July 25th at 8. Friday, July 26th at 8. Gosh, it's 8 o'clock on Saturday. $45 or $20 for tickets for students with valid ID. LumenRep.org/shows/slowburn. Guys, I wish we had more time to talk about this, but we're just about out of time. We have 2 minutes to go. Let's just wrap it up. Why did you pick these again?
Well, I'm an Albee fan, and in our bold season, we wanted to do something where we could present something that you could give people all kinds of reactions in one night that you couldn't get in one place. So we take two pieces where Albee wrote very stylized in one and very realistically in the other, still absurdist, and we decided to embrace two totally different approaches to that. And so Act One, so to speak, American Dream, Intermission, Act Two, The Zoo Story, two very different experiences, very bold, and we hope that people either laugh or get ticked off.
All right. Then I'm hoping you get that. I want to thank both of you for being here, and that is our program. We encourage you to send your feedback and suggestions to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. If you missed anything, catch our rebroadcast at 8 p.m. You can also find our entire archive at WJCT.org or on your favorite podcast platform. Don't forget to listen Saturday at 4 when neurologist Dr. Joe Servin talks to a patient who fell victim to medical gaslighting. I cannot do what I did this week without these people behind the glass. The executive producer of First Coast Connect is David Luckin. Our show is produced by Stacey Bennett, directed by Brady Corum. Jamie Vallee is our associate producer. Fabrizio Gowdy is our production intern. The theme music, normally by Club de Belugas, but just want to get you a little rock and roll here. I've enjoyed this week. Ann Schindler is back in the saddle Monday. She'll be talking about the enduring legacy of Black filmmaking in Jacksonville. Until then, I'm Dan Scanlon, and you've been listening to the First Coast Connect show on this Heatwave Week on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.